I think there's been a kind of idea that throughout the campaign, people had an idea that he was maybe unorthodox or just unconventional, that he would eventually conform to the normal parameters of American politics. And I think that was a faith that some people held out. But obviously, a lot of people on the left did not think that was going to happen. But then, as the presidency has gone on, we've seen some pretty atypical things that have come to define what we've been, I guess, the last 8 months that we've seen of him in office. And so of all the kinds of issues that we go back and forth on in American politics, we didn't expect to see the kind of moral character of Nazi sympathizers to be one of them, or the really significant constitutional issues that come with having pardoned Joe Arpaio for his refusal to comply with a court order. And so I think these are really significant, and for those who are observing, and of course, I'm a New Yorker, native New Yorker, so people who have been observing Donald Trump for decades before he became a public part of American life, I think those things like this are less surprising than they might be for some other people.
Why is it surprising, though? Presidents usually do try to keep their campaign promises.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the thing is that there's the promises that people try to keep, and then there are promises that they really hope people don't try to keep. Because you hope that people are just kind of ginning up, their audience, or kind of using campaign rhetoric for things that are not workable or not really viable politically. And there's that ratio with all politicians, the things that they say they'll do that are probably impractical, if not impossible, then the things that they really plan to deliver on. And I think that there was a faith that Trump, among the more moderate voices, I think, in conservatism, there was a faith that Trump was going to be just a kind of salesman, and maybe there was a lot of bluster and a reality show TV personality, but what you were going to get in the end was not going to be very different from kind of the traditional political operator. I don't think that's been the case.
Why not?
Well, I mean, I think he is who he is. And I think it's hard to kind of discern. I can't give a psychoanalysis of his reasoning, but some of the actions he's taken have been politically questionable, at the very least. The relationship with Twitter and lashing out at individuals from the most powerful pulpit in the country, in the world, really, and lashing out at people on social media, or making the wild accusation that Barack Obama had wiretapped his Trump Tower, which now the FBI said was not the case, and now the Department of Justice has conceded was not the case. I don't really know exactly why that has been, or the kind of unfettered hostility toward media, which I think all politicians, certainly on the presidential level, have at very least a very ambivalent relationship with the media. But the idea that they are the, quote, enemies of the people is very, very much inconsistent with the First Amendment. This is an institution that needs to be protected because they serve a vital function in democracy.
What do you tell your students about that, how to respond to that thread of thought in today's society?
That I think that vigilance matters, that these are the kind of things that are actually confirmation that their work is important, and that after the election, I think there were a lot of students who were, well, the students from abroad who were wondering whether it was safe to be in the United States, and then there were students who were wondering, who were having a crisis of the value of journalism. And I think that it's like, if people are not doing anything against you, you probably are not doing anything. And so if there's a lot you're encountering in terms of opposition, that may be a the most honest form of validation.
Let me take something else from your New Yorker piece. You compare Trump to Archie Bunker, both because of the New York connection, but because of the thoughts that are being expressed. And Archie Bunker was supposed to be a throwback, but he turned out to be a precursor to Trump. Mm-hmm. What sort of precursor is Trump?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that in making that comparison, I was talking about the 1970s and how that character, Archie Bunker, was really this guy who was a working class white guy in Queens. He's pretty much bewildered by the world around him. He didn't really know what all the changes, you know, what all the social changes, you know, meant. And of course, he also was a kind of bigoted person. And you're seeing the world through his, you know, view, his perspective. We thought that was kind of an entertaining, the entertainment value in that lay in the fact that we thought that mindset was aging out of the population. But in fact, what we saw in his kind of concern, you know, in the fictional version of it was Archie Bunker, but in reality, the area of New York, Queens, the county, was rapidly changing in terms of its demographics. It was getting browner and younger and with many more immigrants, and is now the most diverse, ethnically diverse county in the entire United States. And so those kinds of seismic upheavals that you were kind of laughing at in the 1970s, when those began to filter out to the rest of the country, even if it's four decades later, you started seeing the same sort of anxieties that you saw with that character, Archie Bunker. And so in some ways it almost made perfect sense that Trump, you know, as this person from Queens, would be the representative of this tide of ethnic resentment and anxiety.
Some people make the argument that now is a good time because it rips the Band-Aid off of something that has already mm-hmm. been here, and it's good to be able to confront it in the open. And others are saying that this economic argument and fear of culture argument that you've just articulated is actually bad because it allows this fear to take a shape that will persist. Mm-hmm. How do you come down on that sort of consideration?
I don't know. I think it could be both and, you know, that the kind of typical mode in American politics was that when people deployed racism, which people, you know, did intentionally, but they did it through codes and through kind of winks and nods, and you could never quite actually say that what someone did was racist. Now, we can't really make that argument. If we looked at what was said about Judge Gonzalo Curiel and saying that he couldn't be objective because he was Mexican, or about the fable that thousands of Muslims had cheered on 9/11, which even Rudolph Giuliani had said did not happen, it did not occur, or this kind of litany of things that have happened since the inauguration. It's made it very clear and very overt. It's no longer a question of whether or not this is happening. And at the same time, it's been legitimized. These perspectives have been legitimized in ways that are frightening. Because if someone can express the kind of egregious bias, or if someone can make fun of a person with a disability, or any of the kinds of vulgar sexist commentary that we heard during the campaign, if those things can happen, it means that they are now, and a person still wins an election, it means that those ideas are now part of the mainstream, that they are not disqualifying any longer. Or the overt expression of those sentiments is not disqualifying any longer. And that should be frightening, I think.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Jelani Cobb, a staff writer at The New Yorker, a professor of journalism at Columbia University, and the convocation speaker at Illinois Wesleyan University. What other moments in the nation's history does this one remind you of?
Well, it's interesting because there's a kind of very neat symmetry. So it's 2017. If we would look at 1917, you know, aside from the technology and, you know, the obvious changes in the landscape, we would see that our politics and the concerns in society were strikingly similar. A century ago, there was this great consternation about the ethnic composition of the country. There was fear that there were too many immigrants coming in. There were talks of religious groups that were aligned with the enemies of the United States. In this case, they were talking about Jews and Catholics.
There was also, it was about 8 to 10 years after a huge economic dislocation, the Depression of 1898.
Yeah, that's right. And so, and the kind of lingering aftermath of this. And so, if you looked at, and then, of course, the kind of status anxiety that people had about urbanization. In that case, it was people moving into cities and for employment. Now it's the opposite, you know, employment leaving cities. But they still had a sort of social anxiety that gave the impetus for populist movements that expressed some views, some very reactionary views even then. And so if we looked at the 1924 Immigration Act, which I talked about in that piece, the National Origins Act, which was designed to produce immigrants mainly from Western Europe and nowhere else, in, at least not in significant numbers. So that, you know, kind of comparison, if you looked, you know, a century ago, it's not hard to see.
That lasted 40, 50 years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think also, you know, the Great Depression and World War II complicated those things, and they wound up with our views about immigration. And well, there's another point here that's true, is really worth considering, which is the development of the welfare state in the 1930s. Historians have raised the question, and I think it's a really valid question, as to whether or not that could ever have happened a decade earlier, had the Depression started 10 years earlier than it did. Would people abide by the expansion of a social welfare state if they think that the people who are going to benefit are immigrants or black people or whatever group it is that's unpopular?
Well, there was another pressure there, too. The Roosevelt had a very real fear that there would be revolution, that there would be a socialist uprising, and right. So this was meant to curb that as well. So is there a similar fear today?
I don't know if there's that fear, you know, because there's not a kind of coherent outside. What Roosevelt feared, and even kind of went back a generation, those fears that cropped up with Woodrow Wilson and the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, people are looking around and saying, well, you know, could this happen here? And then, of course, by the 1930s, where you're looking at, you know, there's the communist question and the fascist question. So there are these organized external ideologies that people wonder if they'll get a foothold. I don't think that we have that same comparison here. I don't think that, you know, socialism is, well, rather, communism is not a threat to, you know, the American economy or the kind of fascists that we've seen, the resurgent fascism that we've seen has largely been fringe, potentially dangerous, but nonetheless fringe groups. They don't have the control of any state, you know. So I don't think we have that comparison. But there are enough kind of fingerprints in you know, the past that we could look and see, you know, very similar social landscape.
The title of your talk is The Half-Life of Freedom, which is an interesting image. It implies that there is a limited and diminishing quantity of freedom. What do you mean by that?
I think that, you know, it's meant to be provocative in some ways, but we're talking about whether or not freedom is declining. Whether or not it is something that remains as vibrant and as vital as it might have been, you know, in this country at various points. Our concerns about freedom of the press, our concerns about civil rights, our concerns about having a society that fully includes women, our concerns about the things that the social movements of the 20th century really pushed for, and concerns about rights of workers. Are those things really still at the forefront of our minds? And are we, where are we? Where do those struggles stand?